Okay, so let's begin by finishing up some of the themes from the last lecture on global warming. Just to get you back in the mood, global warming poses a threat to the world that is somewhere between a severe crisis and a catastrophe. And anyone who argues that this is not a big deal, that this is not going to cause tremendous problems in the course of the coming century, anybody who believes, who says that, really is uninformed about the best available scientific evidence on the matter and the careful discussions about its ramifications for human well-being. Climate deniers of either the variety that says global warming isn't even happening, or who say it's just part of the natural cycle of climate variation, they are wrong. This is not something that's really up for reasoned discussion. The magnitude, of course, is. There's lots of uncertainties, but the basic facts of the matter are what should be described as settled science. And yet there are many people who believe this is a non-existent phenomenon, or even that it's actually a hoax. The idea that it's a hoax implies that roughly 97% of scientists who study atmospheric sciences and related fields have somehow or other conspired to cook their data in order to serve their own interests. There's a quote from one of the major figures in the climate denial world, Rick Perry, prominent former governor of Texas, heavily supported by the oil industry, seems to have slightly changed his views more recently. But he said there are substantial numbers of scientists who have manipulated data so that they will have dollars rolling into their projects. Is that really a plausible explanation for why 97% of scientists around the world, according to the National Academy of Sciences, believe in anthropogenic global warming, that they're doing it to line their own pockets? On the other hand, the think tanks which argue against global warming are heavily financed by the oil industry, by the Koch brothers, for example. It's a much simpler view to say that the oil industry has self-interested motives in denying the importance of global warming due to fossil fuel and carbon emissions than it does to say that scientists are cooking their data in order to get bigger grants. The oil industry is behaving with respect to global warming much in the way that the tobacco industry behaved with respect to lung cancer. The research of the tobacco industry itself demonstrated both that nicotine was addictive, which they denied, and that lung cancer was significantly connected to smoking. And for years, they brought out scientists to show that these results did not exist, to bring up contrary views in the various hearings and debates over these issues. And the reason they did that, of course, was by simply sowing confusion, by creating doubt, they could delay regulation. That is clearly in their interests. It doesn't require fancy social theory to see why the tobacco industry wants to deny the connection between tobacco smoking and lung cancer, or why the oil industry wants to deny the connection between the burning of fossil fuels and global warming. It's a much more far-fetched idea, I think, that scientists who have been trained in the rigors of research, in the values of truth-telling, and in which they constantly debate all these questions of adequacy of evidence amongst themselves. It's a very far-fetched idea that there's this vast conspiracy of scientists to misinform the public about global warming. Now, I'm not a scientist about global warming. I haven't studied it myself. I do have confidence, however, in the basic integrity of the high end of the scientific community. And again, with respect to the evidence that's available, there is a very, very strong scientific consensus that global warming is real, that it's caused by human beings, and that it will have dire effects on the quality of life in many parts of the world. Well, that's the basic setting of the problem. We've been discussing a variety of general causes, general explanations for environmental problems, and each of these bear on the problem specifically of climate change. Hyperconsumerism, that's the topic of the lecture on Thursday. Consumerism, when it runs amok, when it becomes a dominant mode of relating to an economic activity, leads people to disregard the consequences of how much they consume for the environment and for others. Clearly, we can't continue on a trajectory of consumerism of the sort we have in the United States and imagine that the world as a whole could do this without devastating environmental consequences. Collective action failures, a common problem. That's why we have the free riding problem and we analyze that issue for the environment. It's a very difficult problem in general. It has specific issues with respect to global warming because in order to deal with global warming, we don't just need to solve the collective action problem among individuals, like in the recycling story we told. There's also a collective action problem among governments. You have to get governments to agree and to avoid being free riding on the good policies of other governments. In that respect, it's really crucial that powerful governments like the United States, that are governments of the economy that contributes the most to global warming, take a leadership role in trying to do something about it rather than retreat from doing something about it. Negative externalities. Well, that's a big theme in general in this part of the course and the way markets work, and it's a very important theme with respect to global warming. The global north, the rich developed countries in the world, are the countries that have contributed most to the burning of fossil fuels and to CO2 emissions, greenhouse gases rising. But the consequences are going to be most deeply felt by others. The most severe consequences of global warming and climate disruption will be felt by people living in the tropical regions of the world. People living in relatively northern climates will still have negative effects in general of climate disruption, but they will be less severe. That's an example of negative externalities. We're displacing the costs of our personal preferences or societal preferences over the use of energy onto others. But even more fundamentally with respect to global warming and fossil fuel emissions, we're displacing costs onto future generations. We're making the planet less habitable, less congenial for future people. NIMBY movements. I mentioned that briefly. Recently there was in the news, as I said, protests by people in Cape Cod over the sighting of wind turbines in the offshore in the ocean as visual pollution. Well, these are people who broadly favor conservation. They tend to be affluent, well-educated people who are cognizant of the desirability of renewable energy. They just don't want it in their backyard. Finally, and as I began in my comments today, a crucial part of the problem of global warming lies not just in the preferences and choices of individuals, nor in NIMBY movements about the siting of things like wind turbines. Much of the problem is the result of the exercise of power by powerful corporations whose interests would be harmed. Again, very much in line with the way the tobacco industry, obstructed the public health crisis fundamentally generated by heavy tobacco use, obstructed the solutions by virtue of the exercise of their power. Well, those are the problems. What about solutions? You know, there's a strand of environmental thinking that essentially paints a picture that's so dire that essentially it seems like nothing can be done. And if you really believe that this is an apocalyptic moment where the world is coming to an end, in a sense, you might as well eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we shall die. The kind of extreme version of just not caring about what happens because there's nothing you can do anyway. Well, I do think that there are solutions. Most scientists believe that we are not yet beyond some tipping point in which the dynamics of climate change have become so out of control that they will simply spiral into ever worsening conditions. And whether there is indeed an actual tipping point like that, you know, some point of no return, or whether at any point there are things you can do that will halt the subsequent progress of global warming and gradually bring things back under control, that of course is a matter of debate. Well, I think there are things we can do. First, we can dramatically increase the costs of carbon emissions. You know, this is a market-oriented solution. Markets are good things. Markets provide signals. They help people figure out what the trade-offs are. How much they want to spend on one thing or another depends upon how much things cost. And the problem with having a free market in fossil fuels, the problem with that is that it basically underprices the consumption, the product. The product is way too inexpensive given the total costs of its use. The costs of oil use should reflect the costs to the environment of using it. Think of those negative externalities. We've been talking about public goods. Well, that's a kind of public bad, right? It's a collectively producing something that's bad for everyone by the overconsumption of a particular product. The natural solution in a market economy is not to prohibit people from using oil, from using fossil fuels, just to make it very expensive. But very expensive means pricing it in a way that reflects its true costs to society. Not the partial costs that are just the cost of extracting it and shipping it and processing it. True, those are costs of production. But there is another cost connected to the use of fossil fuels, which is the costs on the environment. We should have substantial carbon taxes. Carbon taxes are one of the ways of doing it. There's lots of devices. You may have heard of cap and trade, where you create exchangeable credits in carbon emissions, and so you have to pay to emit carbon into the atmosphere. And if you're very efficient, you'll have a surplus of these carbon credits, and you can then sell those to people who are less efficient. But that makes their inefficiency more expensive for them. There's lots of devices. They all, or of this particular variety, they work through the market by raising costs to people. The alternative is simply to ration or prohibit the use of fossil fuels. That requires much heavier direct coercive constraint. It could come to that. You know, I mean, one can imagine a crisis condition in which, because of the impediments to regulating the use of fossil fuel, simply cutting it off might be a necessary means. I doubt it. I don't think that's a feasible solution. By the way, if you're interested, there's an extremely engaging Norwegian television series that is now on Netflix called Occupy. And the basic setup of the story is that because of climate disruption, there's a terrible hurricane that hits Norway, of all places. And the result is that the Green Party of Norway gets elected in a landslide election. And they run on a platform of cold turkey cutting off of North Sea oil. They just shut down the oil production completely, knowing that it will be very disruptive, but feeling that's the only way to get through, the only way to have a breakthrough towards a decarbonized energy future. And it creates all sorts of global conflicts in the European Union. It's a very good, I think, Netflix series. You can see a kind of futuristic near future account of what might, it's called Occupy, or maybe Occupied. It's either Occupy or Occupied on Netflix. All right, carbon taxes of one sort or another, some way to make it expensive to indulge is the right word, in the reckless use of fossil fuels to solve our energy problems. Second, significantly expand public investment in clean energy. Accelerate the transition. One, I think, very good idea is to have very heavy carbon taxes and use the carbon taxes to subsidize both research and development and infrastructure development in alternatives. Not just in renewables, but in clean renewables. I don't have particular technical suggestions as to how that money should be allocated. You know, there's solar, there's wind, there's hydroelectric, there's more fanciful ideas around fusion technologies. There's a whole range of energy technologies, and there are some bottlenecks. The issue with wind and solar that continues to be a bottleneck is battery storage. How do you store the energy from high sunny days to be used on cloudy days, like today in Wisconsin? Solar panels wouldn't do you a hell of a lot of good to heat your house today in Wisconsin. Well, there have been big advances in the technical side of this, but those advances would be accelerated if we devoted substantial funds, research funds, to developing battery technologies, rather than letting just the market determine the priorities for research and development. Third, well, that's what I've just talked about, massive public funding for research in energy alternatives. So the second is really just investment in the clean energy itself, and the third is massive increase in funding. And that funding has to be public funding. And if it's public funding, it has to be paid for by taxes. You cannot have a minimalist tax society and have adequate funding for research to deal with global warming. Fourth, expansion of public transportation, and perhaps even free public transportation. We'll talk about that later today. Fifth, subsidize energy efficiency retrofitting of buildings. Energy retrofitting of buildings is a great jobs program because it's very labor intensive. There's no way to do careful, well-designed energy retrofitting of both residential and commercial buildings without it involving lots of labor. And the labor involved is such that some of it requires strength, but not all of it requires strength. It's labor that could be broadly used for as an employment and jobs creation. And in order for the work that's done in energy retrofitting to provide living wages for people, it should be subsidized. It should be subsidized because the work is important for the society, not just for the person or the house or the building that receives the energy retrofitting. And thus, there's a good justification for taking our social resources to support and to underwrite, and to do so in a way that provides good jobs. Finally, and I think this is ultimately in some ways the biggest challenge, we need to think of ways to shift towards a society that's less oriented to ever-expanding material consumption. To think of ways in which we could move the society towards a vision of what the good life is that involves greater free time, greater amounts of time to devote to activity, and less time simply devoted towards expanding one's consumption. The implication of this is that all of these solutions require a reinvigorated democratic affirmative state. There simply is not going to be a solution to global warming if one believes that government solutions are always inferior to market solutions. I will be repeating that mantra. You know, you'll get tired of it, I suppose. This particular theme bears especially in this part of the course, where we're focusing on the ways in which an economy that's organized around free markets simultaneously does deliver the goods but generates problems. And the grand thesis of this part of the course is that, as a first approximation, those problems can only be solved by a reinvigorated democratic affirmative state. Affirmative there means a state that is actively involved in problem solving, rather than abdicates responsibility and stays on the sidelines. All right, let's shift now to transportation. When I designed this course with my colleague Joel Rogers, and we were deciding on different topics, eventually I thought adding this, transportation, would be a really interesting particular focus. In some ways, a course that's called American Society, How It Really Works, it's natural to have a section on the environment, on healthcare, on finance, which we'll be having. It seems perhaps a little narrow to have a class on transportation. I'm using transportation here for two reasons. First, because I think it is actually a pretty interesting, intellectually, it's an interesting problem, the relationship between private choices and public provision. It's one of these aspects of our lives in which there are these two different ways of doing things, having publicly underwritten and provided solutions to our mobility, geographical mobility problem, how to get from A to B, and purely private solutions. Both exist side by side. And clearly, I think, most people would say some mix between these two is desirable. A world with no public transportation, where the only way to get from point A to point B is to have a privately owned means of transport from A to B. Most people say, no, that's not ideal, especially for high-density cities. On the other hand, almost nobody that I can think of would say we should completely abolish private means of transportation. So some kind of mix is needed, and therefore it poses a nice problem. How should we think about the principles that should regulate that mix? So let's just begin with some basic facts. These are sort of basic facts about public transportation in the United States compared to other places. First, this is data from the period 2005 to 2009. The percent of urban trips by the type of transportation in various countries. Urban trips by types of transportation other than cars. Right, so everything else is automobiles. Well, as you can see, the United States relies least on walking, cycling, and public transportation of any developed country. The private solution, of course, cycling and walking are private solutions. I mean, you own your own legs, and most of the time they're usable. And I used to have a really nice bicycle. When the summer comes and I am given permission by my orthopedist to once again get on a bicycle, I'm going to treat myself and get myself a good bicycle again. So I'm undaunted by the threat of automobiles. Well, maybe a little daunted. Just the United States relies on automobiles more than any other country. And in some countries, most famously perhaps the Netherlands, there's just massive use of walking and cycling. If you ever go to the Netherlands, it's really fantastic to go to a train station and see the bicycle parking lot. I mean, it's gigantic, the bicycle parking lot. by train stations. It's the standard way that people combine using public transportation, you know, commuter rails of one sort or another, and bicycle transportation. Now, in the United States, there was a time, a century or so ago, where we had quite a lot of riding of public transportation. This basically ended after World War II. In the 1950s, there was a precipitous decline until around 1970 or so, and it's been relatively flat ever since. These are the annual trips per person on average, the annual trips on public transportation per person. Well, that call is just not going to get answered. This is misbehaving. I'm going to put my airplane mode on now. There. Okay. This is the percent of people using different modes of transportation travel to get to work in the United States between 1960 and 2009. 1960, 1980, and 2009. Automobile ridership, riding to get to work, has increased. It was always high, but it's gone up from 65%, 68% to 90%. Driving alone has increased. We have less carpooling, not more carpooling. And public transportation and walking has increased. This, of course, results in the highest annual per capita gas consumption of any country, orders of magnitude more in the United States than most other countries. Well, all of this, one might say, well, at least getting to work, because you can just get in your car, you have point-to-point vehicular transportation, right? You don't have to walk to a bus stop and then walk from a bus stop to work or a subway or whatever. At least one might think this increased driving is efficient. Well, here's the annual hours of delay per traveler due to traffic congestion in various American cities and how that has changed from 1982 to 2011. The annual number of hours of delay per traveler. Just think about what this means. 60 hours of delay. So this is of delay. It's not 60 hours of transit time. What it's asking is, how long would it take you to get from home to work if there was no traffic? You know, if you went at 2 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, if you went at a time when there was no traffic to impede you, how many extra hours of travel do you have to spend because of congestion? 60 hours a week. You know, the typical work week is 40 hours. That's a week and a half of actual work time. That's devoted simply as a surplus to get to work, on top of what would be an unimpeded commuting time. Clearly, the increased traffic and the increased reliance on automobiles, on private transportation, is affecting productivity. This is productivity loss. It means that people have to spend more of their lives to produce whatever they're producing, because the transit time to get to where you're going to produce it is actually part of the time you're devoting to your work. It's just, you don't get paid for it, but it's actually part of the society's allocation of human time for the purposes of work. And then this is an estimate. This is done by, you know, traffic engineer specialists. It's a complicated set of calculations. It's based on the fact that congestion means that you're burning more gasoline, so there's a cost of the actual driving goes up because of congestion. And then estimates due to the some kind of imputation of the costs of the lost time. The annual congestion in terms of costs in billions of dollars in 2011 in the cities of Los Angeles and New York were over $10 billion. $10 billion wasted simply because of congestion. Well, how should we understand this problem? This brings us back to our familiar friend, the free rider problem. The free rider problem. We keep encountering the free rider problem. When you're talking about public transportation, there's always a certain awkwardness in saying the free rider problem of public transportation. Some people might think we're talking about people who sneak onto subways without paying. You know, the turnstile jumpers in the New York City subway system. No, we're talking about our familiar friend, the free rider problem. The basic way to think about it in general, again, just to remind you, a free rider problem occurs when you want everyone else to make some kind of sacrifice, to cooperate with what's in the public good, but you don't want to. You want to be a free rider on their sacrifices. Well, let's think about it, look at it this way. You can make one of two choices. You live in an environment where there's only two possibilities. You can take the bus to work or you can drive. In the particular environment in which you live, you can't take a subway because they don't exist. It's not a choice. Your only choice are buses versus cars. And in most American cities, that's the practical choice. New York is the big exception to that, where you can choose for substantial parts of the city whether you're going to take the underground, well, the subway, the underground in London, the metro in Paris, or drive. But in most cities, your choice is between buses and cars. Well, here's the setup. If everyone else takes a bus and you drive, it takes you 10 minutes. If everybody takes the bus, it takes 25 minutes. If you take a bus and everybody else takes a private car, it takes 1.5 hours because there's so much congestion and the bus makes stops that it takes you longer to get there. And because if everybody else is taking a car, there aren't very many buses. If everybody drives, it takes 45 minutes. Now, in the standard free rider problem, collective action problem story, we say this person is only thinking about themselves. They just want to get to work as quickly as possible. Their best option is B. The second best option is A. The third best option is D. And the worst, the nightmare option, is C, right? B, A, D, C. That's the preference ordering, the rank order of alternatives. In this story, if all you care about is how quickly can I get to work? Well, the problem is everybody else thinks just like you. You know, you're not a peculiar person that only cares about getting to work quickly. Everybody does. And they look at this table and they say, well, if everybody else takes the bus, the best thing for me to do is to take a car. And if everybody else takes a car, the best thing for me to do is to take a car. Aha, I'm going to just take a car. It doesn't matter what anybody else chooses. Everybody decides that and you end up in D, taking 45 minutes rather than 25 minutes. That's the classic free rider collective action problem. Well, here's a peculiar thing about this problem when it's with respect to public transportation. The exact times that you put into this table depend upon what the alternatives that you actually face are. The thing about cars and buses is that they generally are on the same roadways. So automobile congestion impedes the speed of buses. Buses go more slowly where you have a lot of traffic because they're both on the streets. It's quite different if the options that are made available to you, if the options that you face in your environment are light rail rather than cars, rather than buses. Because light rail systems, you know, like subway systems, or in some cases, trolley systems that have their own corridor so that they don't compete with automobiles. Having lots of cars on the road doesn't slow them up. All right, so here then is the payoff matrix if you have a light rail system rather than a bus system as your choice. It's still the case that if everybody else takes rail and you drive, it takes you 10 minutes. If everybody takes rail, now it takes 15 minutes because rail is more efficient, goes faster than buses do. If everybody drives, it takes 45 minutes, just like in the first story. But if you take a rail and everybody else drives, it takes you 25 minutes because the rail still isn't competing with all those cars on the road. The reason it takes you longer if you take the rail and everybody else takes a car is that there are fewer rails, you know, the fewer trains if everybody's driving and you're the, you know, in the story I say you and everybody else. Obviously, it's you and a few other people versus most other people in a real world example. Well, what does this mean? It means that the free riding gain, the payoff you get for being unconcerned about what's good for everyone, not feeling any obligation, the free riding gain is much smaller. In the previous example with a bus, the free riding gain was 15 minutes, right? You got to work 15 minutes quicker if you rode in your car and everybody else took the bus. Secondly, what's called the sucker penalty. The sucker penalty is how much extra does it cost you if you cooperate and nobody else does? That's the sucker penalty. You're a sucker to ride the bus if nobody else is and everybody else is driving. The sucker penalty in the bus case was 45 minutes. But look, in the light rail case, there is no sucker penalty. Even when everybody else is riding cars, you're better off to ride rail. What this means is that the decision space, the choice options, or to use the economist terms, the payoff matrix, is much more favorable to encouraging people to use public transportation when they have a good option, light rail, than when they have a less efficient option, such as buses. What this means then is that the environment of choice, how that feasible set, what are the set of options that you face, how that is determined, will shape how you think about what your best choice is. How much you have to feel a kind of sense of moral obligation versus just, I want to get to work as quickly as possible. How much you have to be willing to cooperate depends upon the nature of the choices you face. This is similar to the recycling story where we said one of the solutions to recycling is to make it really easy for people to recycle. You know, so if you make it hard for people to recycle, you have to separate different colored of glass and it has to be separated from cans and separated from paper and they have to be taken to a recycling center on the other side of town. Almost nobody's going to recycle if the costs of recycling are that high. But if you make it easy, like in Madison and many other places, where you just have a recycling bin and you just put everything in it, well, it's still a bit of effort to recycle, but not much. And therefore, the gains of free riding go down. And that's what happens when you have different kinds of transportation choices. Okay, so that's the basic kind of key theoretical idea. Now let's see how we should think about the desirability of public transportation. And the basic idea here is that there are positive externalities of good public transportation. There are positive externalities of good public transportation, not just an absence of negative externalities. So what do you think are the positive externalities of good public transportation? Aha, question. Let's do this quickly. Turn to somebody next to you. And let's do a solid intense minute. What are the positive payoffs? Think of all the different kinds of positive externalities. Not just for the rider. You know, for the rider, that's a positive internality. They experience it. What are the positive side effects of really good public transportation? Go, talk to your neighbor. Okay. Suggestions from the floor. Positive externalities of free public of public transportation. Yeah. Less pollution. Right. So there's exhaust from cars. Less pollution if you have a good, efficient public transportation. Yeah.
Less traffic.
So less congestion. We save on those congestion costs, and that means that those people who do need to drive for one reason or another will find it easier to do so. Yeah. Less accidents, that's good. I mean, I think in general, we think that public transportation is likely, I haven't seen, you know, accident statistics. Occasionally you get accidents on public transportation, but I think it's certainly true that public transportation is less likely to hit unwary bicyclists, so public transportation, less accidents. That's a good positive externality. Other ideas, yeah?
Cut down on drunk driving too, because everyone can get where they need to go and not worry about driving.
That's right. So it's drunk driving happens late at night often, and it's not so clear how it's going to affect the 2 a.m. bar close. But probably drunk driving would be a bit less of an issue if you had good public transportation. Other ideas? Anybody in the back? Come on, the people that you don't get away without talking just because you're in the back. Yeah. More jobs for drivers. Well, that's interesting, because if you look at the overall employment effects of a really good public transportation system versus everybody driving, it isn't so clear, because people would need fewer cars. But it certainly is a positive feature that it provides good, stable jobs. But whether that balances out or not, I think that part wouldn't be so instantly clear. Other ideas. Yeah?
It's good for tourism.
Good for tourism. Well, it's true that one of the pleasures of going to New York is, you know, you arrive, you get to your hotel, and then you can just get around the city without having to rent a car or worry about your own private transportation. The taxi system in New York is also should be thought of as a feature of its public transportation system, even though that's provided by private companies or Uber drivers these days. Other ideas? Okay, well, here's just a couple of others. I'll just go through my list, some of which we've already talked about. Quicker commuting times, less congestion, we said that. Saving on private car infrastructure, fewer parking ramps, street repairs. That's a big savings in public expenditures. And if you really add up all of that, it's even possible that the long-term savings in public infrastructure for automobiles would go a long way towards directly paying for public transportation. Less pollution. There's actually been estimates about how much savings there would be in house painting, because one reason why you have to repaint your house is because air pollution leads to deterioration of paint. Health benefits, especially for asthma. Less pollution and air pollution also has positive health benefits. A more efficient labor market, especially for poor people. It's easier to get to jobs, therefore less need for welfare. One of the problems in a city like Milwaukee is the difficulty of people who live in the poorer parts of town getting to where there are jobs for which they would be qualified. It's not just a question of them not having the skills or education for jobs, it's that the jobs for which they are qualified aren't located where they live. And they can't afford to live in the places where the jobs are available. Well, a really good public transportation system facilitates that. Less need for multiple cars in a family. Well, that obviously increases the discretionary income of people given whatever their income is, if they really only need one car per family rather than two because of the availability of public transportation. Energy savings. Well, the question then that follows from this long list is what is the true economic value for all these public positive externalities of good public transportation? If you added up all of these positive effects, if you added them all up and tried to give a reasonable monetary value and compared the monetary value of existing public transportation compared to a really expansive, dense public transportation system, particularly in large cities with high density populations. Right, so you did that comparison. My guess, and I haven't done these calculations or seen them really worked out, but my guess is that the savings, the value of all the positive externalities would be so large as to make the appropriate price for a ticket on public transportation zero. That essentially, if public transportation used to the max provides all these positive benefits, then the most appropriate price for public transportation that you charge the user is zero. You shouldn't put any cost to the user because any price that you put on it will reduce the use of public transportation and therefore reduce the positive benefits from it. The most rational economic pricing for public transportation for rides, I think, is zero. I'll discuss this a little bit later. Well, those are the reasons why public transportation would be a good thing. Why is public transportation so underdeveloped in most places in the United States? I'm going to illustrate this story. Now, why is that still there? I think I have to... by showing you a very brief video. Let's see if this gives us the video. I don't know why I keep having trouble with this. Let's see if this gives us the video. No, that doesn't give us the video either. Okay, let's see if this gives us the video. Yes, okay. There's a movie from 20 years ago called Who Framed Roger Rabbit. How many of you have seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Okay, the basic story of Who Framed Roger Rabbit is that there's this neighborhood in Los Angeles called Toontown, where all the cartoon characters live. And a particularly nefarious character named Judge Doom wants to destroy it, knock it down, and build a freeway through it. And he's confronting the chief, good doer in the detective in this story, and they have this discussion about public transportation. In the chapter on public transportation, you will see the story of the destruction of the LA public transportation system. It's a famous incident, which I'll tell you about in a moment. But let's see this brief video first. It's just 2 minutes.
Can you guess?
Whoops. Now, why don't we get sound? I should have checked this out. I thought you automatically got sound when you had an HDMI connection. Do you have to do something special to get sound?
This is...
That's not going to give us much sound because it's... Oh, this will be very disappointing because it's very silly and... But... Are we getting it? Okay, well, semi-successful. What Judge Doom says is that he... Oops. Let's close this off. He said he would... that he bought the red car, which is the name of the subway station, the trolley system in Los Angeles of the time, and he bought it so that he could dismantle it. Well, that story is, of course, done in a silly way in the film, but it actually reflects the process by which transportation choices were made. So here's one incorrect version of how transportation choices were made in the United States. Cars are convenient. People like cars. We are have wide open spaces, the romance of the automobile. Individual consumers simply decided to buy cars, even in large cities like Los Angeles. And public policymakers responded to the preferences of consumers by building highways. Building highways led people to move to suburbs, which increased congestion as they commuted to work, and so highways were widened. And you got a cycle of building bigger highways, which enabled people to move further away, which created more congestion, which led to building more highways. So this automobilization of the economy and the accompanying building of highways is simply a response to the autonomous preferences of individual consumers as they figure out what's best for them. The market decided. That's one story. But here's another story. Early in this process, there were various obstacles that corporations saw to the market for automobiles. It wasn't so obvious that people were just going to buy cars, and especially not buy multiple cars. particularly in those places that had pretty good public transportation. Los Angeles, in the late 1940s, had, by many accounts, one of the best public transportation systems in the United States. General Motors saw this as a problem. It purchased the public transportation trolley system and converted them into buses. It tore up the tracks. You know, the trolleys ran on tracks and had their own corridor. It tore up the tracks and replaced them with buses manufactured by General Motors. It did so both because this would enable it to sell buses to the public transportation system which it now owned, but also because it felt that this would encourage people to buy cars. This story became a kind of scandal in congressional hearings in the 1960s, which is the basis for the section in the chapter on transportation, the information from those public hearings in Congress in the 1960s, which shows that this was a direct exercise of power by a private automobile company. That company then, the General Motors, formed a lobby group with tire companies and with highway construction companies. There was a kind of, you know, cement, tire, and car lobby that used its considerable lobbying power to push for a particular solution to congestion problems, namely more highways, bigger freeways. This becomes an almost irreversible process because it costs much more to go back and build on the older forms than it is to just continue with the form it is. The capital investment costs rise over time as standards of living and labor costs rise. And people have made such large private investment in cars that they resist paying the bill for the reversal of this congestion problem. So you get a kind of lock-in. This is referred to in social science as a form of path dependency. Once you've destroyed those fixed rails, pulled them up, it's very tough to reverse it because the costs of creating a subway system in Los Angeles now are astronomical. And the coalition that would support building it is weak, because people have invested in cars, plus there's all of the infrastructure around automobiles that has been laid down. By the end of the 1950s, there was a very strong consensus in the United States about automobilization. And this combined with interests around freeway construction, as I've said. And all of this then created a world in which we rely very heavily on cars, even in urban environments where that's clearly irrational, where it clearly produces huge negative costs for everybody. The reason we're locked in then is because the environment of choice that people face has been determined by relations of power, not simply by the autonomous operation of their preferences. Public transportation infrastructure is never the result simply of each individual saying, this is what I prefer. Rather, it's the result of some kind of aggregate process through which power is exerted. And in this case, it was the power of large corporations. Well, what are the solutions to this? How do we go from here? How should we think about changing the parameters under which people make their individual choices so that we can move to a more rational, more efficient mix between public and private forms of transportation? Solutions. First, no free parking. I mean, free parking is basically a subsidy to driving because it costs to produce parking spaces. By no free parking, I even mean in malls in which the parking spaces are privately paid by the owners of the mall, so they pay for the asphalt and for devoting such a huge amount of land to parking for their customers. They don't charge the consumer, the customer, to park, therefore making it really economical to drive to malls. The price that the costs of that parking is absorbed into the overall overhead costs of the mall. People should experience the negative externality of driving when they park their cars by having the cost to the society of having parking borne by the driver, not just absorbed into the costs of infrastructure. We certainly need to devote much more resources over time to building infrastructure for transportation alternatives, bike paths and rapid transit especially. Madison turns out to be extremely good for bike paths. I don't know how many of you bike. Madison is in a tight race with Portland as being rated by various bike magazines as the two most bike-friendly cities in the country, my being hit by a car notwithstanding. We need to increase residential density. This is a problem. Suburban sprawl, the creation of gigantic houses with huge lawns and backyards on the peripheries of cities, the McMansion problem, leads to very low density housing. Now, it's true, people like low density housing, but low density housing has all of these negative externalities to it. It's much more difficult and expensive to build a good public transportation system under low-density housing. Not impossible, because you need to have a system then of getting people from the low-density housing to transportation hubs efficiently, and that's pretty hard to do with public transportation. That's why having over time zoning rules and development plans to increase urban density not only creates all sorts of advantages with respect to energy use, it's also one of the conditions for making for an economically viable public transportation system. The full cost of driving should be reflected in gas taxes. So gas taxes both are a kind of carbon tax, right? They're a tax on the burning of fossil fuels. But more significantly, gas taxes really are the way, one way of informing the driver of what the true costs of driving are. It tries to bring to bear on the driver's decision making between driving and using public transportation what the negative externalities of using a car is. This is a chart from 2012 of the pre-tax price per gallon of gasoline and then the post-tax price. The United States, again, is an outlier. The pre-tax price of gas per gallon is not very different across countries. You know, in Norway, it's a little over $4 a gallon. This was in 2012. In the US, then it was around $3 a gallon. You know, the prices are obviously lower now than they were then. But there's not much variation across countries. There's huge variation in the post-tax and how much taxation is imposed on top of the price of gasoline. And the justification for that is not merely that it's a source of tax revenues for roads. That's a big issue in Wisconsin, where we have had a deterioration of roads in Wisconsin because we have such low gas taxes. And the governor refuses to raise gas taxes because of his general view that taxation of any form is evil, and therefore he'll just oppose any tax increase, regardless of its necessity for solving collective problems, in this case, deteriorating roads. We just have extraordinarily low taxes on gasoline, and that's basically cheating the public. You know, it's basically giving artificially low prices. At the gas pump, What you're paying is an artificially low price. In effect, when you buy cheap gas with low taxes, you are being subsidized by the low taxes. A full tax on gas that reflects its total costs to the society, that full tax would mean that you are paying what you should pay given all of the negative externalities of driving. And that would provide resources for expanding public transportation. Finally, we fully should recognize the value of positive externalities in the price of public transit tickets. This is the point I alluded to earlier. If you really calculated all of these positive externalities, all of the ways in which taking a tram, taking a subway, taking a bus reduces costs in the society, that is, their positive externalities, then the price of public transportation tickets probably should be free. You know, it's very difficult to put a monetary value on all those positive gains. Some of them are quite diffuse, others are quite specific. When we went through, remember, the positive externalities of public transportation. But I think it's almost certainly the case that if you added those all up and gave a good time horizon for them, you know, saying both in the long run and the short run, that public transportation should be free. There is indeed a kind of social movement that's emerging globally for free public transportation. This is a website, freepublictransportation.com, that goes into the ins and outs of free public transportation around the world with lots of interesting examples and discussions among activists in different cities around the world. In Brazil now, there's a very active no fare movement that really is arguing for free public transportation as a social justice issue, not just as a transportation issue. Here's just one example of the annual bus riders in the town of Hasselt in the Netherlands, introduced in July of 1997, and what the impact of having free public transportation was on the use of public transportation in that small city. In the United States, we do have some places with free public transportation. The Staten Island Ferry in New York City is free. It's a nice thing to do if you're ever visiting New York City. You just go to Lower Manhattan and you hop onto the Staten Island Ferry and you get a free ferry ride across to the island of to Staten Island. This is a map that shows places around the world where free public transportation currently exists. There are quite a few places in the United States. Now, most of the places in the United States have limited free public transportation. There's often in the downtown corridor, there'll be a free public transportation. Madison has free public transportation between the university and Eagle Heights, you know, the residence area for graduate students. So lots of cities have partial free public transportation, but there are some cities in which all public transportation is free, simply paid for by taxes. And in those cities that have done it and studied the, once everything settles down, what the balance sheet looks like, the actual costs to the community as a whole of a free public transportation system turn out to be a savings. It's cheaper for everybody concerned when you have a free public transportation system than before you had it. Because people buy fewer cars, they save on that. There's less wear and tear on the roads, all the things that we discussed. This is also from that website, so this is a list of where places around the world you can go where you can get at least some free public transportation. So here's the big message. The big concluding message. A free market in transportation is inefficient. It does not deliver the goods in the right way. It is inefficient. Because, first, there are large positive and negative externalities of different modes of transportation. And free markets are terrible at registering the advantages of positive externalities and the harms of negative externalities. So wherever you have a market in which there are large positive and negative externalities, depending upon the mix, depending upon what you do, markets are going to be inefficient. They're not going to provide the optimal mix of products. And second, the second reason why a free market in transportation is inefficient is that the optimal choice for an individual depends on the range of options available. You rent a car if you visit LA for a week, but not New York City. When I go to LA and have to spend some time, I rent a car. When I go to New York, I never rent a car. And I'm just acting as a selfish individual, so to speak, just asking, well, what's the best thing for me to do in order to get to my appointments to take care of the business I have to take care of? I make those choices differently. A free market cannot produce the optimal range of options from which to choose. So markets work well when they can produce the full range of options within which then individuals can make a rational choice, depending upon their priorities, their preferences, their budget constraints. Markets do a poor job when the range of options is determined by forces other than the preferences of individuals. Markets do well where it's reasonable to talk about consumer sovereignty. They do poorly when really what you have is corporate sovereignty, the power of corporations and other powerful groups determining what the range of options that you have available. Okay, on Thursday, we will tackle consumerism.